Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bound. What does it take to craft an iconic look? Well, on today's show, we're interrogating that very question. But unless you're James Dean, we're not so interested in the jeans and t-shirt you might have thrown on to pop out for coffee. No, we're talking about the outfits, haircuts, and makeup that appear on the stage, the red carpet, or that hang in a gallery. We're looking at the process and meaning behind the art of styling. Our jumping off point for this is a new memoir by Susie Ronson, the woman who snipped and dyed David Bowie's hair into that Ziggy Stardust cherry red mullet, and a star, or rather a star man, was born. We'll also be examining how a 19th century portrait painter might be viewed as an early pioneer in the art of styling, and catch up with a stylist currently in the business to reflect on the joys and perils of the job in a world of internet virality and Instagram comments. That's all coming up here on Monocle on Culture. During the late 19th century, John Singer Sargent became one of Europe's most sought-after portraitists. Works such as Madame X of a young socialite in a form-fitting black satin dress with delicate jewelled straps is one example. It's not only a well-known painting, but a work that perfectly encapsulates the close attention Sargent paid to the styling of his sitters. His paintings can be seen as a masterclass in the depiction of pinning, draping, and tucking. With his sitters swathed in gauzy tulle and glossy silk, his brushstrokes capture every crease and fold, every puffy sleeve or rumpled skirt. A current exhibition at Tate Britain highlights how Sargent worked like a stylist to create these looks and includes some of the clothes and accessories worn by his sitters. Here's my conversation with the curator, Dr. James Finch, about the exhibition, accompanied by the music that Sargent listened to while he was working.
For us, the starting point for the show was identifying fashion as a passion throughout Sargent's career and something that he was always interested in. He was, of course, a portraitist by trade, but I think even amongst portrait painters, there's something very distinctive about the way that Sargent paints garments and textiles, and he's particularly kind of in love with them, you know, the way that light plays on fabrics, the different textures of different fabrics, all of that is very much to the front in his portraiture. And I think that's kind of a prevailing passion throughout his career. And so that was really the starting point, and kind of identifying that as something that had never really been dealt with in focus before. And then from there, taking it on to actually investigating which of Sargent's, the clothes in Sargent's portraits, which of those actually survived and which of them we might be able to actually introduce into the exhibition and put them alongside the paintings so that you can actually look from one to the other and you can see what Sargent's thought process essentially, because by comparing and contrasting you can see what he's interested in, what he's focusing on, what he's leaving out. And so that's really at the heart of the exhibition, and that's what distinguishes it from any previous exhibition of Sargent's work.
Yeah, it's wonderful how you zero in on, as you say, the textures, the brushwork. And this isn't at the expense of the meanings of the portraits themselves as symbols of prestige, power, status, etc., all the things that portraits are always about. There's a nice resolution, I suppose, in taking it towards fashion. Is there a tension, I wonder, do you think, between paintings of sumptuous clothes and portraits of important people? I wonder if there is, when we think of portraits, we might think that we are getting a window into the soul. This show seems to be saying that the clothes can say as much about the sitter as the face, as the posture, as the eyes, as it were, right?
Yes. I mean, I would say that in Sargent's work, both of those things are going on. And I think there is actually a tremendous amount of psychological insight in Sargent's work. The caricaturist Max Beerbohm described him as the artist of a nervous age. He said that it says a lot about the period Sargent was working in, that his sitters never seem at rest. They always seem as though they're mid-thought, mid-speech, as though they're about to get up. And that in itself says something about the social instability and kind of the changing world that Sargent lives in. So I think there is all of that, and that's very much been spoken about elsewhere. Mm. But I think that what we wanted to really focus in this show was that alongside that psychological acuity, you'd also have this kind of the love of painting the clothes and that was something that was very much to the fore in the criticism of the day. When Sargent's work was exhibited and the critics wrote about it, they would often spend as much time talking about the dresses in the paintings as they would about the technique. And so there were lots of debates started about the dresses in particular Sargent paintings and how successful they were, and actually about kind of the colour of the dress, for instance, as, you know, something suitable or unsuitable to be painted in this grand scale portrait manner. So there's a lot going on.
You go into detail on design, like the Christian Dior of his day, the House of Worth, which was an outfit which had 1,200 odd employees, I think you say, in the exhibition catalogue. And so this is obviously taken seriously, and none more so than by Sargent himself, in the precise setups, as you're perhaps alluding to, not always the most comfortable setups, long, you know, sittings for these things, often with, you know, sometimes with mothers and daughters, mothers and sons, you know, people that aren't necessarily great at sitting still. Tell us about the work that went into the, before you know, a pencil was sharpened or a paintbrush was dipped. Tell us about the setup, that some of the setups that Sargent was in charge of.
I think one thing to say is that many of these portraits, to begin with, they weren't actually commissions from patrons. And so while there is this sense of Sargent as, you know, society portrait painter who had this long list of people wanting to be painted by him, but some of the best known and some of the best portraits in the exhibition were actually undertaken at Sargent's instigation, whether we're talking about Carmen Sita or Madame X or Graham Robertson or Ellen Terry. Those are portraits which actually, at the very start of the process, it was about Sargent approaching the sitter and saying, I really want to paint your portrait. Mm. You know, I have this great idea. In the case of Ellen Terry, for instance, he saw her acting as Lady Macbeth, and he approached her and said, I want to paint you in that outfit. And so that's actually the first step in the process in many cases. But in some of the other situations where a portrait was commissioned, the sitter would often have their own ideas about what they wanted to be painted in. So Eleanor Iselin, for instance, this New England society figure, she commissioned Sargent and she had him round to her house, and she laid out all of her newest dresses and said, which one would you most like to paint me in? And she was wearing this fairly standard black day dress, this walking dress. And Sargent looked at all of these options and looked at what she was wearing and then said, actually, I'm going to paint you in what you're wearing.
And that is such a beautiful portrait.
It
seems so alive. And for compared to some of those works, casual, actually, because, yeah, maybe Sargent's caught his sitter in exactly how he wants to capture her, I suppose.
Exactly. So there's very much this sense of improvisation and spontaneity. The portrait of Robert Louis Stevenson, for instance, he's basically walking from one side of the canvas to the other, because Sargent says of Stevenson, he is the most intense person I've ever met, and his speech and his constant pacing around are his defining characteristics. And so he's finding all of these different things in the people he paints, and he's trying to find ways to fit those into the portrait.
And Stevenson as well was not immune. One of the greatest novelists of the day was not immune to dressing up like a writer should, right? This is nodded to in the show as well, isn't it? That you might be searching into, you might have a searing eye into the soul of the human condition as a novelist, as you might as a painter, but you're still playing some sort of a part. And Sargent was brilliant at capturing this.
Yes, that's something that we really want to emphasise throughout the exhibition, that the act of making a portrait, of painting a portrait, it's perhaps performative by its very nature. It's always a construct. It's always a collaboration between the artist and the sitter. It's always creating a version of yourself to be seen in public. And so whether we're talking about writers wanting to emphasize their bohemian characteristics, or whether we're talking about society figures or politicians wanting to really look as powerful and as high status as they possibly can, Sargent at every turn is a part of that process, and part of the reason he is so sought after and so successful is just how good he is at bringing out those different things that his sitters want to say about themselves.
Dr. James Finch there, and Sargent and Fashion is on at Tate Britain until the 7th of July. Now we turn our attention to Susie Ronson, who crafted David Bowie's iconic Ziggy Stardust hairstyle in 1971. She then joined the Spiders from Mars on their global tour. Hers is a story of the Cinderella sort. Plucked from the unglamorous sight of a hairdresser's in Beckenham, southeast London, Ronson was propelled to the bright lights of rock and roll. There she sourced ball gowns and glass slippers for Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. She was their stylist and hairdresser as they broke onto the global stage and broke new ground with their flamboyant suits, dramatic haircuts, and iconic makeup looks. She then married Mick Ronson, David Bowie's phenomenal lead guitarist, who sadly died at the age of 46 in 1993. But it's mostly the upward trajectory captured in her new book, Me and Mr. Jones, My Life with David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars. And I was really delighted to be joined in the studio by Susie Ronson to discuss it.
It is wonderful and an honour, Susie Ronson, to have you on the programme today.
So kind of you to have me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. Congratulations on Me and Mr. Jones.
Such a
great read for rock scholars and style scholars. You know, both will get such a huge amount out of it. Before we kick off at about the specificity of how you styled Mick and David Bowie, I wanted to ask you about the general sense of the style in the early 70s. Because certainly there was Bolan in terms of the pop kind of aristocracy, but it was an unstructured time, looks-wise.
It was a lot of jeans and T-shirts, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a lot of denim and T-shirts, and I think that Mark, before David, actually, just before David, just kind of pipped him to the post with a bit of glitter on his cheeks on top of the pops. David ushered in a huge change. Mm. Suddenly people weren't wearing jeans and T-shirts on stage anymore.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It morphed very, very quickly into people like Kiss. You know, he took it completely to a different level. And Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
So David, yes, changed it. But I like to think that he was very stylish, the way David changed.
Yeah.
He wasn't vaudeville. It was definitely very classy. I thought his look was very classy.
He sort of appears in your book with his wife Angie on Beckenham High Street, where you're in the hairdresser.
I was a little suburban hairdresser.
You were, and yes. how she's grown up, that Susie Ronson.
That's what my mother said.
They hove into view, pushing a pram, and they are dressed as the other one might well have been via the social and sartorial mores of the time. Susie,
yes.
Tell us about that. About the first time you set eyes on David and Angie Bowie.
Well, I was in the hairdressers, and our receptionist, an elderly Doris, you could hear her go, "Oh, whatever next?" And of course, we all had to go to have a look. Heather, our junior, said to me, "Come out, have a look. And every shopkeeper ran out the door to have a look at David and Angie walking down Beckenham High Street.
He must have hated that.
Oh, he had this big floppy hat on, and he had this long blonde hair, and she had tight black jeans and a furry jacket. And he was pushing this pram, and he was wearing a dress with boots and a hat. And, yeah, everybody ran out to have a look. We couldn't believe it. And the receptionist, Doris, told everybody about it. Anyone that came in, "Did you see that man in a dress, you know, down Beckenham High Street?" So he definitely created a stir.
I feel like, therefore, Bowie would have been very receptive to your initial kind of style. I mean, it started off with a haircut.
It started with the haircut.
Right? You were cutting Angie's hair and then his hair?
I'd cut his mother's hair.
That's right.
That's how it first started. I met Mrs. Jones and she would wax poetical about this son, David. Oh, this and that. And I would smile and nod, as you do. And it wasn't until she mentioned Space Oddity that I suddenly realised who she was talking about. It was David Bowie, David Bowie's mum. Then she brought her daughter-in-law in, Angie. Now, Angie, she was American, number one. She was tall, skinny, looked amazing. I mean, she wore this little jacket and these jeans. You don't buy clothes like that in Beckenham. And as I say, she was American. So it was a complete fascination for me. She wanted me to do something outrageous with her hair. And I put bright stripes down the side of her hair, which no one was doing at that time. And she loved it. She came back Christmas week, but we were full. Everyone's full Christmas week. Yeah. So I followed her out and said, I can come to your house if you like and do your hair. So off I went to Haddon Hall, which is where I met David.
This had the kind of the commune vibe, I suppose.
Not really. It was one of those big... I think it had been more than that.
Okay.
It wasn't. When I went there, it was just the two of them living there. The band had already moved. But prior to that, the band lived in what was loosely called the Minstrels Gallery up top. And David and Angie lived downstairs, but they brought tons of friends home all the time.
Yeah.
It was really quite the place to be. But when I was there, it was just her and him. And he was looking at this magazine. He showed me this haircut of this little short red spiky haircut. Girl, said, can you do that? Well, I said yes, but I wasn't sure that I could. And it was a girl's haircut, which really shocked me. I said, a girl's haircut. In the 70s, this was quite unusual. But I did cut it that night. It was a miserable failure. It wouldn't stand up. It just kind of flopped. He looked like a schoolboy. That was a little humiliating. But I was convinced that once we had got the colour, the texture would change and it would stand up.
Yeah.
And it turned out that with some very strong setting lotion,
yeah,
it worked. I mean, we didn't have setting lotions in those days. We had soft setting lotions or dippity-doo. But we didn't have what we have today.
But those two guys, I mean, your Mick and Bowie had some, I mean, they obviously had, they had some good raw, you had some good raw materials to work with there.
Oh,
some
God,
decent,
yes. gorgeous looking blokes,
high cheekbones,
yes,
and good hair.
Yes, and good hair
to start off with. Right, it wasn't like you were messing around with sort of some wispy old nonsense.
No. They all had great hair, and Mick didn't let me touch his hair for quite a while. It wasn't until he got to Phoenix. And we were waiting for David because it was David wasn't flying. So we're waiting for British people, Phoenix, in the sun, swimming pool. Couldn't be happier. So Mick was in the pool all the time with massive amounts of chlorine in that pool. And Mick's hair was bleached, of course, so it went green. Then it fell off. So he got spikes whether he wanted it or not.
Right.
That's when his spikes were born, after the swimming pool incident.
With Bowie and the Spiders, were you kind of pushing against an open door in terms of styling there? Or was Bowie lapping up suggestions from magazines, from, I know, obviously, Japanese fashion, Japanese designers, Kansai Yamamoto and people like this, Rei Kawakubo. What about Mick? Mick was from slightly different stock.
He was as pretty as Mick was,
There
was nothing, you know, remotely gay or fey about Mick.
Yeah.
He was definitely a bloke,
yeah,
very masculine bloke. And I think that image against David's femininity somewhat was enchanting, wasn't it? It was amazing. There was like a masculine and feminine energy on stage.
Mm.
But he looked so pretty, Mick. I mean, he was actually quite pretty, Mick.
Yeah.
But he was very muscular. But he was small and wiry and tight. Very good-looking man. Very good-looking.
Tell us about the kind of your sort of raw materials, Susie. Like the, you were right there in the middle of, and one of the architects of this look. You know, the Ziggy hairstyle and some of the clothing as well.
I think that in the back of my mind, after I'd done his hair, I thought, where's he going to go to get a touch-up? Where's he going to go to get a little trim? He's going to have to keep me around because how else is he going to get his hair done? Remember, David wasn't famous at this
point. It's a good trick, do 99% of the job.
Yeah, really.
Exactly.
But, I mean, I knew I had to do more. And David was open to suggestion. David was like a magpie. He collected from everybody. And he didn't make you feel like a twit for saying something. You could suggest something and he'd listen to you. He might not take it on board, but he'd listen. And he was the same with everybody. So Freddie Beretti, who helped design the costumes. But really, it was David and Angie in charge of that whole look. They were all outrageous, very outrageous, those two, really. And they went to this club in London called the Sombrero Club, which was basically a gay club. But, of course, gay people have such style, don't they?
Yeah.
And these certainly had style too, so that was really good. And then I just started looking after stuff. Yeah, the bracelets, the shoes, the tights, the bits and the bobs.
Was this stuff easy to source, though? Stuff of this, that, with this look and feel, I mean, this kind of this glamish
stuff. They had the costumes that were made. Freddie Beretti made the costumes.
Yeah, right. And also, it was kind of David, as slim as he was.
Oh, yeah, he could wear anything.
I guess, yeah. I mean, obviously, there have been these wonderful exhibitions. I saw it in Brooklyn. It was at the V&A in London.
That was a fabulous exhibition.
Minuscule waistlines.
Tiny,
beautifully
too.
Made. Yeah.
Very short. I mean, I was in big fear of my life that I would weigh more than he did when we got together. You know, I thought, geez, he might. I think we weigh basically the same.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of a little embarrassing when you're with a bloke, isn't it? You want them to be a little bit bigger than you. But I think the style was something. David loved it and he embraced it and he looked really good in it. I mean, after a while, when we were in the States and people would come to the gigs imitating his look, 200-pound hairy trucker doesn't quite look the same as David did with that haircut. And his hair was a little short. I mean, I just didn't know where to look. He had the makeup on, big, hefty bloke, and his hair was like that long. Well, he couldn't really stand it up because no one knew how to do that. But it was curly, so it was a little biz. It was hysterical, but I felt for him. You know, he wanted to look like David, and there was never a way in the world. But he wanted, he tried. He did try.
It must have been amazing to see, you know, get on tour in the US, let alone across the UK, and seeing people ape these looks, seeing it on Top of the Pops, these kind of moments that are broadly now considered to have changed culture, you know. Like
Who knew then, though?
Yeah, I know. But did you, I mean, how did it feel at the time? Did it just feel like another day, another dollar, another hotel?
No, it was never about the money, that's for sure. It was more about.
I said $1.
You know, well, yeah, but, you know, it was... When I did see people in Carnegie Hall, there was a lot of people that were imitating David's looks, and I thought, oh, my haircut's everywhere, and it did feel a bit like that. It wasn't until later when I realised punks, a mullet, that all came from my haircut. That all came from my haircut. And even today, I'm still talking about the haircut, what, some 50-odd years later, which is amazing to me. Yeah. I'm still talking about that haircut. But remember, when I did David's hair, he wasn't famous. He'd just had the hit, Space Oddity, but it had been 2 years before.
Is it? He was sort of drifting around in one-hit wonder territory.
Exactly.
There, yeah.
That's what I thought he was, but he found Angie. Massive, massive influence and help. He found Ken Scott, that producer from Trident, brilliant producer. He found his manager, Tony DeVries. For what anybody says about Tony DeVries, he certainly put tons of stuff together for David. And he found Mick Ronson. So his team sort of gelled. And you don't realise it until it's done what an amazing team he had.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to do whatever they could to make this work. We were such a great team for him.
Yeah. It's wonderful. I mean, it comes through the warmth of that. It seems to happen so quickly in your book, despite the fact that there is a whole book dedicated to it. Your tone of voice is speedy, you're very direct, you're looking the reader in the eye the whole time. We're very much in Haddon Hall, we're on the road in America, we're in all these dressing rooms. That's the way...
Well, that's exactly how I wanted to write it. Yeah. I wanted to walk you through the story with me.
Yeah. Now, that's I feel like I'm...
I'm so glad. That's very
being
flattering.
Being glad-handed through
that's
these wonderful
exactly what
moments
I wanted. That's exactly
history.
How I wanted the book to sound.
Yeah.
The first time I did do it with my publisher, they changed it all. They put it in the past tense, and I was like,
yeah,
what are you doing? It kind of lost me a year, but I got my own way. But I liked it. I like it in the present tense. I think it's more exciting.
It is easy to get... You're caught up in that energy
excitement. That's what
I wanted it to be. That's where it puts us. It puts us
because it was exciting.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I was this girl from Beckenham, suddenly whipped up into this world. My poor mum and dad whipped up into this world of craziness and survived it.
Yeah, it's
thrived,
stunning.
Actually.
Looking at it sort of down the other end of the telescope, Susie. What about other acts and things? As you say, this Bowie's look and mood and the energy of that era. It was a bit similar to maybe what Roxy Music were doing as well. There's a lot of mirrored jackets and things going on there.
We had a lot of wannabes after
There was a lot of wannabes. So
who do you judge
favourably in the sort of style state?
Oh, I think Roxy Music were great.
Yeah.
I mean, even Rolling Stones started to embrace our look. Mick got on stage in a dress with his eyeliner and everything. Right. Well, he wasn't doing that before. They all started to do it. I mean, Alice Cooper, I say, took it to the other end. Kiss. I thought Kiss might be a bit late to the game. How wrong was I, you know, because they went on and even Mott the Hoople put on their glitter rags and their high-heeled boots and stuff, right? But no one did it quite like David. David was so classy. I think it had a lot to do with the way he looked, his figure. He was
very androgynous. He was a good actor as well. He was a good performer. He was a very good actor, wasn't he?
And
he'd studied mime and all that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was so ambitious and he had such wonderful ideas.
It's beautiful. It's wonderful to hear a little bit about the writing of the book, me and Mr. Jones, but it's just wonderful to meet you in person.
Thank you.
Who, of course, dear listener, is very stylish herself.
Thank you.
Susie Ronson, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me to your show. In the corner of the morning in the past.
Susie Ronson there, and Me and Mr. Jones is out now, published by Faber. And finally, we wanted to get a glimpse into the styling industry as it exists today. Emily Evans is based in London, but works all over the world dressing stars for the red carpet, for magazine shoots, including Vanity Fair, as well as full fashion shows. She's worked with the likes of Ashley Graham, Kate Beckinsale and Lewis Hamilton. And here is Emily.
If it's something like the Met Gala, it's like an all-out. That's like our fashion Olympics. If it's for an actress who's receiving an award, we want to kind of make her a bit more serious or, you know, respected. Or so it really depends. And it also depends on the client and what they feel comfortable in, because I try and push people a bit out of their comfort zone. But at the end of the day, you know, like if someone said to me, wear this, and I'd be like, I would never wear that. I also respect that in a woman as well, or a man, that, you know, we can all dream that we'd like someone to wear something, but you have to also respect the fact that it's not about creating a viral moment for people. It's actually about them looking really good for their career. A lot of the time, people will have quite specific ideas with their management team about what works, what their vision is, what their aesthetic is. Sometimes they don't, so sometimes I'll come on board and help build that aesthetic, or they might decide that they want me because they want to go in a different direction. I do like a really deep dive. If I'm working with somebody new, I do a really deep dive on their career, on what's worked, what hasn't worked. And then I'll often say to them, what have you really liked? What have you not liked? And then I always start with a mood board. Sometimes what someone's got in their head isn't what I've got in my head, or sometimes my visual references might not be the same as someone else's. So I find to actually do lots of mood boards so we can be like, are we here or are we here? And then once we kind of decide exactly where we are, then we can start with the actual clothes. So there's quite a long process before you actually put clothes on someone's body. And I think the worst thing for me probably is when somebody wants to look like somebody else. And it's like, let's try and create a brand new style for you. I will always take backups, even if we've decided on the day, because you never know what's going to happen. Sometimes something will rip. You know, I've been in a situation just before Christmas that, you know, someone's boyfriend stepped on the train and the whole dress ripped, you know, like 5 minutes before she was going to go on the Jimmy Fallon show. I mean, like, I always like to not prepare for the worst, but I will always take some kind of option with me. You know, shoe, heels break, you know, zips break, all sorts of things happen. Luckily, I'm a really quick sewer, so the main thing is always have a sewing kit with you. If ever I have an assistant and they can't sew, I'm like, go and learn to sew and then call me, because it's not going to work. You have to sew. You have to be able to thread a needle. Like, that's literally, like, I always walk around with threaded needles on my shirt or jumper or whatever I'm wearing, because there's always a last minute sew up job. Back in the day, you know, somebody would be photographed for the Oscars, and then you'd have to wait until Tuesday for Hello magazine to come out, and then everyone saw it. So I think the amount of time that things come out is insane. I mean, somebody can be photographed before they've even got to the event, getting out of the car, and the world knows what they've worn. The other thing that's changed completely is that everyone comments on it now. So on Instagram, everyone's got an opinion. I would say my best moment career-wise and personally was probably Ashley Graham for the Met Gala last year, wearing Harris Reed.
Yes, I'm wearing Harris Reed. And this is an idea off of Carl's 1987-88 Haute Couture Chanel dress, and it was same color, same hips.
Amazing.
Harris did a Harris twist.
Love it.
And my body came and said, hello.
I think the theme being Chanel was a blessing and a curse, because obviously it's a huge responsibility, and it's kind of such an incredible brand that you want to do that theme justice, whatever anyone thinks, whatever anyone comments on. If the person that's hired me is totally happy and isn't looking around the room thinking, oh, she looks better, or I wish I was wearing that, or whatever it is, that to me is amazing, that she can come back to the hotel room afterwards and be like, you nailed it. That for me is like everything. That's what I do, my job.
And that is it for this week. My thanks to Emily Evans there, as well, of course, to James Finch and Susie Ronson. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the show. We will be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thank you for tuning in.